exactly who that would be. I'm hopeful that nobody was envisioning the person that they'd like to take out. But let's suppose that you were interested in killing that person by poisoning them. Would you use a fast-acting poison, or would you use a very slow-acting poison? And I don't know really the difference between them, and I suppose there are such things as slow-acting and fast-acting poisons. But I would imagine that which one you chose to use would depend upon some options that might be available to you. What options, you might be asking? Well, what about the opportunities that you might have to administer that poison? Would that make a difference if you had lots of opportunities to administer it? Or maybe there's just a one-shot deal and you've got to get it right. What would you choose to use under those circumstances? Now, the reason I ask that question is because there is somebody who wants to kill you. There is somebody who would like to take you out. And he has designs on how he might do that and has been giving considerable thought as to the things that would really work in killing you off. Satan wants to kill you. He wants to kill you spiritually, if not physically. And I will tell you tonight that evil's objective in your life is really pretty simple. The Bible tells us that the devil would like for all of us to die spiritually, if not physically, but spiritually to be sure. And there are many weapons that are at his disposal. There are many different things that he has calculated on using depending on the circumstances, depending on the person, depending on how many opportunities he might have with that particular person. I think all of us need to come to terms with the fact that there are no circumstances whatsoever under which evil has your best interest at heart. Evil has my demise in its sight, but it has no interest in doing anything that would be beneficial or good for me at all. My eternal best interest is the last thing Satan has on his mind. Evil does not bless us in any way. Evil does not seek our highest good. I have tried to imagine all of the things that Satan might have available in his arsenal, and I will tell you that the Bible is really replete with example after example of things that the devil has used to kill people spiritually. The things that he has used to poison, the things that he has used to take people away from the Lord, and he has this enormous arsenal. He has all sorts of tools. He has all kinds of devices. And let me tell you that depending on whom Satan is wanting to take out, if you're a person who belongs to the Lord, if you're a person who is relying on God every day of your life, that doesn't mean Satan has no interest in you at all. In fact, it means that he has a greater interest. You are prey that the devil really wants to go after. You are the most challenging particular person to him. Because those who rely on God present Satan with some special difficulties. They present him with some special problems. He's going to attack us, but he's not going to use the same weapons to attack us that he uses on people that have no relationship with God whatsoever. In fact, I guess it could be argued that for those who have no relationship to God whatsoever, he has very little really to do. He doesn't have far to go in killing them off and causing them to be lost eternally. But I believe one of Satan's favorite methods for spiritually killing people who have a relationship with God is by poisoning them. No, it's not warfarin, which is the component in rat poison, I understand. Of course, some of you here may be taking warfarin as a drug. You may have made the connection between those two things. What kills the rat also makes your blood flow freely in your veins, that blood thinner that warfarin is that you might be taking. But the point is, we are familiar with lots of different poisons that might be out there, and Satan is also very familiar with spiritual poisons. And let me just remind you that he is a very, very patient poisoner. He doesn't have to do all this overnight. It's not going to bother Him if you linger for quite a while, or if you show really no signs whatsoever of having been poisoned for quite some time. If it's necessary for evil to use a slow-acting poison that takes a long time to produce spiritual death, well, that's okay. He's not on a schedule. He's not got to get this done by a certain date. If evil can separate us from God a little bit at a time, well, that's okay as far as the devil's concerned. In fact, that's fine, because if he can separate us from God just a little bit at a time, we might not even know what's going on. We might not even recognize that we're sick or that there's some substance within our spiritual bodies that is killing us little by little. If that separation occurs so gradually that we don't even realize that we're being killed, as far as Satan is concerned, that's excellent, because we'll put no effort into resisting this or trying to find an antidote for whatever this poison might be. And you know, if this poison begins to taste pretty good to us, if it begins to be palatable and something that we might even enjoy to the extent that we don't really see the evil as evil, well, that's wonderful as far as the devil's concerned. Because if it tastes good, we'll eat more of it. If it tastes good, we'll not try to spit it out. If it tastes good, it'll be something that he realizes is to his great advantage in poisoning us. And if we reach the point that we even defend evil because of our conviction that evil is maybe not so bad, in fact, it's good, well, then he's got it made, if he can move us to that point in our thinking. One of Satan's favorite tactics among ethical people devoted to God's principles is to poison our minds against our God and to blur our distinction between influences that are godly and influences that are ungodly, so that we don't even know the difference between those things. And then when difficult moments present themselves in our lives, perhaps those difficulties will cause us to turn away from God rather than turn toward Him, and then the devil's work is actually done. The issue is not, are you going to have tough times in your life? Every single one of us will. Every single one of us does. The issue is, how are we going to react to those tough times that occur in our lives? And will those difficulties poison us against God, or will those difficulties cause us to cling more closely to our God and to flee to Him as the source of refuge from trouble and problems in life? I want to use someone from Scripture tonight as someone to challenge our thinking along this line. And I just invite you to take your Old Testament and open up to the book of Daniel. And we're going to let Daniel challenge our thinking just a little bit. We're really just going to survey two chapters in this book. We're going to look at Daniel chapter 1. And then finally in the lesson tonight, we'll go over to Daniel chapter 6. And the first incident that I think we ought to zero in on here in this chapter, chapter 1, has to do with what happened when the city of Jerusalem fell first to the Babylonians. And the first group of people from Judea who entered into Babylonian captivity included some sons of the royal family, as well as some of the people from the upper classes, the upper social strata in Israel. And that certainly was not an unusual occurrence in warfare at that time. But I would say that it probably was a serious blow to the faith that some of these Israelites had in Jehovah God, because I'm sure that many of them were thinking, whoa, how could this be happening to us when we are God's people, when we belong to the Lord, when we have this covenant with Jehovah, and now we're being carted off into Babylonian captivity? I mean, Jerusalem contained the temple of the living God, and Jerusalem's citizens were certain that the city could never be taken, not because it was so militarily protected, but because it was God's city. This was Mount Zion. This was an impregnable fortress as far as they were concerned from the standpoint that God had built a hedge around them. And of course, God had warned them, yes, but God had warned them so long and so often that sometimes they perhaps thought God doesn't mean all these warnings and He's trying to stir us up, but He'll really never get around to punishing any of us. They did not believe that when God warned that ultimately evil was going to be punished even within the nation of Judah, that it ever really would be. So all of a sudden Daniel and his friends find themselves captives in Babylon. This could never have happened. This was not supposed to turn out this way. God had not prevented their capture. God had not circumvented their deportation to Babylon. And you know what they could have reasoned? They could have said, why should we honor a God who would allow something like this to happen to us? If God would allow our nation to be toppled by those ungodly, uncircumcised Babylonians and us be hauled off into captivity, why should we honor Him? But in Daniel chapter 1, you don't see that attitude displayed at all. They did not begin to question God. They did not begin to poke an accusing finger at God. Instead, really, what I find happening in Daniel chapter 1 is that they begin to rally around their faith in God and they turn to God and the things that God has taught them in His Word. You know, the king in Daniel chapter 1 wanted to prepare some Israelite captives from those upper class families to serve in his court. And from what we're reading, and I'm just going to hope you're reading along and thinking about Daniel 1, I'm not going to read the chapter tonight. I'm wanting you to get the information out of it as we look through this. But as Daniel was one of those upper class young men, we obviously see that he was not alone in being prepared to be brought into Babylonian society, because apparently there were many other people just like him who were being brought up and being trained and being re-socialized so that they could accept this new culture. And of course, there were some things that they were looking for. The king was looking for people who were very intelligent. He was looking for people that were physically perfect specimens. You shouldn't be able to look at any one of these people brought into the king's court and say, oh, he's ugly. Or he has this blemish, or he has that defect, or he has this physical problem, or there is this thing that stands out about this person that's a little bit repulsive. No, these had to be healthy looking people. They had to appear to be very prosperous. As I said, they had to be skilled and intelligent enough to be able to learn a new language and to learn all of these new things about Babylonian culture, etc., etc. And their presence in the king's palace served several important purposes. For one thing, the young men that would be brought into this king's palace were visual reminders of how powerful this Babylonian king had been militarily. I mean, his servants, people that were serving him, had come from another nation's finest families. Not the offscouring of Judah. Not the people that didn't amount to anything in Judah. But the very best of the best in Judah. Those were now the servants of the king of Babylon, you see. So that elevates him in the eyes of those that were around him. And daily it would remind him of how great he was and how accomplished he was as a ruler to be able to take captive those sorts of people from one of these other nations. Not only this, but having those smart people in his court would mean that whatever wisdom they had acquired and whatever intelligence they possessed were available to him when he needed to make a difficult decision. This increased his cabinet, if you will, of advisors to the point that he would get another perspective and more wisdom whenever there was some difficult decision. And the fact that these young men, whoever they were that were put into his service, looked healthy and looked robust, would say to people, look, if you serve the king, you have everything that life can offer you. And if you serve the king, you will become prosperous and you would be the most fortunate person to get a government job like this and to work for the king of Babylon. And their physical appearance, you see, would reinforce the king's ego and would make his power over the nation even more solid, because people would say, it's hard to argue with success. I mean, look at these people that are working for the king. How good looking they are, and how healthy they are, and how wealthy they've become, and all of the things that they had at their disposal that made them look like somebody you'd want to be. There was a 3-year preparation period. We might call it by a number of names. We might even say it was an internship. But there were 3 years of preparation for service in the king's court, and it involved an intensive amount of education. For one thing, these Hebrew boys had to learn a new language, and they learned the language of the Chaldeans. Not only did they learn the language of the Chaldeans, but you will find in verse 4 that to do that, they had to learn the literature of the Chaldeans, which would have been pretty impressive that Jewish boys, Hebrew boys, would be able to come into Babylon and they would learn this new language and they would learn all of this culture and they would get it out of the literature that had been written really just for the Chaldeans themselves. And not only that, but I get the impression from what I read here in chapter 1 that these fellows were on a diet, all right, but they were on a seafood diet. They were to eat all the food they saw. And the food that they saw was not stuff that you would expect people to lose weight on. In fact, I'm thinking that I might have had a chance in this king's court to look pretty good because I think there would have been a lot of rotund fellows there, sort of like me, who were round in face and looked like they hadn't missed a meal any time recently. And I think that that's exactly what you have when you've got these banquet tables that were just filled with all kinds of delicacies that common people would not ever be able to have, and all of the wine that would have flowed freely, and all of the diet that would be there to fatten them so that the king was not surrounded by sickly, weak-looking people, but he was surrounded by robust persons. People that had, you know, something to grab hold of when you needed to get a hold of somebody. And they were people that looked like they were in great health. And so those in preparation ate and they drank what the king ate and drank. What do you think the king was eating and drinking? The best. There wasn't anything substandard or just something to get by on. The king here was eating the very best that anybody could eat. But therein was the problem for the Israelite captives. You remember this story, don't you? Because here Daniel and his friends, they're being given a portion of the king's food. They're being given a portion of the king's drink. But that has all been offered to the king's gods. And it's been dedicated to the king's gods. And not only that, but some of the things that were on that menu, some of the things that were in this lineup of food to be eaten were things that Israelites, by law, by the Mosaic law, had been told, no, you cannot eat this. This is not for you because you are a separate people. You are a holy people. I've sanctified you for purposes that separate you from what other peoples may be doing, including what other peoples may be eating. And both of those situations were spiritually unacceptable for an Israelite who was trying to honor God with his life. But here they were captives. Who are they to defy the king's orders? They don't have any freedom. What ability do they have to resist this education? And by the way, they didn't resist the education. By the way, they didn't even resist the new names that they were given. They didn't resist the new language that they learned. They didn't resist all this new reading that they had to do that they'd never been exposed to before. But when it came to their diet, when it came to the things that found them having to violate the law of God, they said, absolutely not. So what does Daniel do about that? Well, Daniel and his friends, they talk to the overseer, the person who's responsible for training them, the person who's going to be answerable to the king if something bad happens to the guys who are under his care and his tutelage. And so Daniel goes to him and he says, would you let us eat some vegetables? And would you let us drink water instead of the wine and instead of all of the delicacies of the king's table? Could we eat the vegetables with which we are familiar? And the commander liked Daniel. He didn't have a problem personally with Daniel. But he was afraid to grant Daniel's request because he knew that if something happened and then they came to him and said, hey, the reason that these three guys or four guys, Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, if these four guys are looking a little more less robust than the other fellows that are being trained, the question's going to be asked, well, why is that? And somebody's going to say, well, it's because the king's servant here is allowing them to eat a different diet. And he felt like that might come back on him. And he said, the king will have my head. And so I can't do anything that's going to put myself in jeopardy. And Daniel proposes this test. He said, let us eat our vegetables. Let us drink our water. Let us do that for 10 days. And then you compare us to everybody else. And you make the decision about whether or not we're looking satisfactorily, whether or not we're as robust and whether or not we're as healthy as you want us to be. And so after having conducted that test at the end of the 10 days, they learned that Daniel and his friends had fared quite well. In fact, they were fatter than those eating foods from the king's table. And the commander continued allowing them to eat vegetables and to drink water. And because in an extreme circumstance where it looked like they had no choice but to give in to the evil commands that had been given them, and because they had turned to God, God blessed them with even greater knowledge. And He blessed them with even greater intelligence. And these Israelites who relied on God were 10 times more useful to the king than anybody else in his court. Read the rest of the book. And the book is not about those other folks that were in training. The book is about Daniel and his friends and about the achievements that they reached and about the role that they played in not only this king's administration, but in 3 different administrations. In fact, a whole change of government that comes about by the end of the book. And it's because I believe they turned to God rather than turning away from Him that God made them very useful to the king. And the king ended up being better off because of having these men in his court. Now, I want you to flip over to the last chapter of the book. The middle chapter of the book, which is chapter 6. Because here we have years later an old Daniel. He's probably in his 90s at this time. A lot of people don't read this chapter with the understanding that Daniel's an old man by the time you get to Daniel chapter 6. But an old man he is. And he served in a position now of great prominence under a different king of a different country who had now routed the Babylonians. And this man was by the name of Darius. And King Darius's empire was huge. I mean, if you take a map and you look at the spread of that empire, that Medo-Persian empire, it was vast, and he needed all the reliable assistance he could amass to govern a kingdom that was that large. And so he had to divide up his kingdom and place over his kingdom 120, the Bible calls them satraps. We don't use that word today, at least I'm not familiar with our using it in governmental circles, but we might say governors. We might even say lieutenants. We might even say secretaries. There are just all kinds of different terms you might use to describe what these men were. But his entire empire was divided up among 120 different administrators, and he placed those 120 administrators under a committee of 3 who answered to him. Sometimes these are called commissioners. And Daniel was one of those. Daniel was one of those fellows who was at the top tier of the leadership of the Medo-Persian Empire. And everything these men did and everything they oversaw was to be sure that the king's best interest throughout that empire was being maintained. Now, as you read Daniel chapter 6, you're going to see that Daniel was an extraordinary man. And he did only those things that were in the king's best interest. Daniel did not rob the king. Daniel did not lie to the king. Daniel did not try in any way to undermine the king or to unseat the king from his throne or to do anything like what happens with scandal and intrigue and with those who try to lead a coup d'etat or some such thing to get rid of a governing official that they don't like. No. Daniel did everything he could possibly do for King Darius. He tried every way that he could to make sure that his interests were supreme. And the king was so impressed with Daniel that he was close very close to placing the entire empire under Daniel's oversight. And the other men that Daniel served with, as well as all those administrators and other commissioners, they became quite jealous. They became very envious of Daniel's relationship to the king, and they were aware of the king's high regard for him. And they decided that some way or the other, we've got to destroy the respect that this king has for Daniel. And they tried to find some incident in which Daniel, as an administrator, would have acted corruptly in his own interest and not the king's. But try as they might, they couldn't find anything. You wouldn't have to dig too far in most government circles today to find that sort of thing, but I'm sure they were looking in his trash can, and if he'd had internet, they would have been scouring his emails, and they'd have been going down and getting all the bank statements, and you know what would have been done to try to figure out whether or not this guy was corrupt. And they did everything at their disposal, but they could not find one single instance of evil that Daniel was perpetrating against the person for whom he was actually working. And so they came to this remarkable conclusion. They said, if we're going to destroy Daniel, the only way we're going to be able to do that is to find Daniel in defiance of some law of his God. And if we can get him to be faced with the situation where he will either have to disobey the emperor in order to obey his God, or he'll obey God and disobey the emperor, if we find him in that kind of conflict, maybe we have a chance at being able to remove him. And so they went to the king and they declared that everybody agreed that the king should pass an irrevocable injunction against making any petition, that is, offering any prayer to anyone but the king for 30 days. And of course that was a lie, because Daniel didn't know about this, and they said everybody had agreed to it, but they'd not consulted Daniel and gotten his opinion about the matter. And in his arrogance, this king thoughtlessly agreed and made an irrevocable injunction punishable by death in a lion's den. And everybody, at least everybody thinks, they know that story. So Daniel, with foreknowledge of this event, and with understanding what was going to take place, and knowing all along that the king had declared that someone should not do what he was going to do, which was to pray, as he had always prayed, he went ahead and he prayed to his God three times daily from a window that faced in the direction of the city of Jerusalem. And there were spies who were seated about watching, because they knew that if it was time to pray, a king's injunction against it was not going to stop him. And so they let themselves rejoice, I guess, with knowing Daniel so well that they knew it precisely how he would react to this sort of situation. And so when Daniel prayed, as Daniel ordinarily and customarily did, these men brought it to the king's attention. And the king then became very distressed by that report, and tried to figure out some way that he would be able to deliver Daniel from the injunction, but there wasn't any way that he could deliver him from that law, because the Medes and the Persians decided that the law was supreme above any ruler, and so once something had been signed into a law, even the ruler himself would have to be governed by it. And so that evening, the king had Daniel arrested. And he had Daniel placed in that lion's den as the order decreed. And the king told Daniel when he put him in the den, he said, I believe, Daniel, that your God that you constantly serve will deliver you. Which was amazing, wasn't it? That he would have that kind of confidence that the God of heaven would preserve Daniel, because Daniel, he believed, was a righteous man. They sealed up that den of lions to make certain that Daniel would be protected from, well, anybody else that might try to harm him, I suppose. And the troubled king fasted that entire night, and early in the morning at daybreak, the text tells us, he hurries down to that lion's den to find Daniel fine as he could be. He had been protected from the lions by the Lord. And Daniel was taken from the den. His accusers and their families were placed in the den. And In fact, the text tells us that before they even reached the bottom of the pit where the lions were, that the lions began to tear them limb from limb. They were hungry. They'd been out there all night, denied anything to eat. And so they killed these perpetrators of evil against Daniel immediately. Now, Daniel could have reacted to this crisis by saying, you know, I've honored God all these years. I came to this country as a teenager. Here I am, an old, old man in my 90s, and all these years, all I have ever tried to do is honor God, and where did it get me? It put me in this horrible dilemma that no old man like me should have to be in. And here I have faithfully served God all these years, and here in the twilight days of my life, I get thrown into a lion's den. It gave advantage to my enemies. Did Daniel say that sort of thing? He did not. And that is amazing to me. It is remarkable because it is so different than what most people under those circumstances might do. And Daniel continued to pray prayers of honor. He continued to give thanks to his God even after the lion's den. Even after being put in harm's way. You know, there are people in our materialistic age who are tempted to reason that God rewarded Daniel so wonderfully through those years that Daniel really didn't have any choice to make at all. Don't forget that Daniel was not in Babylon because he wanted to be there. Daniel was not even in the king's court because Daniel applied for the job. Daniel had done what every faithful person to God does. He's faithful wherever it is that he may present himself. Don't forget that Daniel in all these years never went home, never went back to Judea, never went back to the place from whence he had been taken. Don't forget that his loneliness in a place that did not serve God must have been enormous. I've often wondered at the conclusion of the workday when Daniel went home to attend himself and to take care of those duties that he felt so seriously about toward God, if he didn't just marvel at how these pagans he worked with every day, how lost they were and how crazy they were. You ever had that experience? I'm sure some of you who work in the public and you deal with people that don't have faith, or if they've got a faith, they've got a misplaced faith, and you see them dealing with crises and you see all the junk that goes on in their lives because they're not trying in many instances to be moral or to be righteous or to be godly. And you look at those people and you say to yourself, oh, how can they stand themselves? And how do I manage to work for people like that? How do I deal with people like that every single day? He had to be very, very lonely all of his life. From what we read in the book of Daniel, he did not have a family to go home to. There's no hint, there's no indication here or anywhere else in Scripture about Daniel having a wife to commiserate with at the end of the day, or Daniel having children that he was trying to rear, or any such thing as that. Daniel was a government man. He worked and he did what that king bid him to do. And when he went home at night, it was Daniel and his God and Daniel and his faith. And Daniel was dealing with infidels from start to finish all day long. Evil everywhere around him. Do you think evil ever tried to kill Daniel? It did, didn't it? Was Daniel attacked because evil wanted him taken out? Were people trying to poison the minds of the king against Daniel? Well, absolutely they were, even if it meant they had to lie about him. Even if they had to misrepresent him. Or even if they had to trick him into circumstances where he would be forced to have to choose between whether he was going to serve his God or whether he was going to serve that king. Daniel was under attack every single day. And yet, the reason we admire him, the reason that Scripture upholds him as such a tremendous example, is because living in that hostile environment, Daniel said, I know who I am. I know whose I am. I know why I'm here. And I know what I'm going to do. And that's why we admire him. That's why I can preach about him. That's why we can talk to young people about Daniel. You can talk to old people about Daniel too, by the way. Because we see him from a youth all the way into what would arguably be a senior citizen plus. If you become a senior citizen at 65, he'd pass that a long time ago. Actually, become a senior citizen at 55 at McDonald's. You can get your coffee, you know, at that time, a little bit earlier than maybe some other places that would let you have that discount. Denny's does that too, I've observed. And if you're wanting to know why I know all of this, there's a good reason for it. I can tell you that for sure. But we can come to the point in our lives where we recognize we're not young people anymore. We may not be aged, we may not be elderly, but we're not in our youth. And yet, in our youth, or in middle age, or in our aged years, we still find ourselves one way or the other under Satan's attack. And Satan attacks us with evil. He wants to take us out. He never gives up on the possibility that he might be able to make evil look good to us. Now let's make a few applications of all of this and close our lesson. If I were to ask each of you tonight to write down the ungodly ways in which our society that we're living in has changed in recent decades, I think all of us who've lived any length of time would be impressed by how many slow but effective poisons are being perpetrated against righteous and godly people in our generation. One tablespoon or maybe teaspoon at a time, evil is poisoning us. Sometimes we're pretty sensitive to it, and it doesn't take much to sicken us and to realize, ooh, something's wrong here. But in many instances, we're getting just enough that it's not really killing us, it's not making us sick, but the cumulative effect, we say, will ultimately be recognized and be visible, and we will begin to feel it. You know, there are matters, I think I've lived long enough now to understand that there are matters that distressed us a few decades ago that rarely cause us to blink today. And I'm concerned about my children, but I'm really concerned about my grandchildren in this regard. You know, sexual sin is a commonplace reality. I mean, it's just everywhere. Now, it's always been existent. I don't mean to say that we live in a generation that's sexually immoral and this is new. No, it's not new. People have been sexually immoral as long as there have been people to be sexually involved. But I am going to say that in most of our experience, we've seen some things that have been accepted just sometimes as means of recreation. Sometimes things that are just openly endorsed and expected without any qualm whatsoever. How many people do you know right now who are unmarried, men and women now, but they're living together? And I would imagine that every one of us, if we think long enough about it, and think about your neighborhood, think about the people with whom you work, think about some of your family members, think about others that you know, that they live together, and does anybody fuss about that? I mean, you've got some problems with it, but sometimes do you feel like you're the only one who does? And that if you ever mention it, people want to hush you up because, you know, in 1955, you might have said something about that, but this is 2014, and we don't talk about those kinds of things today. We don't make those judgments against people. What about materialism? Materialism's a powerful force where people just think that what they have defines who they are, and if they don't have certain things, that defines who they are, and their entire life consists, they think, of the abundance of things which they possess. To the contrary, Jesus says that a man's life does not, Luke 12, verse 15, does not consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. He says that should not be the determining factor about what your life is. But our world is eaten up with this idea that the more goods we can amass, the more money we can save, the more we can have, That's just good. That's just great. That's just what life is really all about. I think there are people who think that the important measurement of a meaningful life is how much pleasure you can get out of life. How much enjoyment? How much leisure time? How much... I had a guy one time tell me, he said, I never take a job unless it means I've got more golf time. You know, if I've got more time to play, then that's what determines whether or not I'm going to work for these people or not. And, you know, we kind of laugh at that, but does it underscore something much worse that we just really rather just do what we want to do rather than what we ought to do? And I'm not talking here tonight about people that are not Christians. Just mark them off this list. I'm talking about Christians. I'm talking about children of God. We can even consider them as good, maybe understandable, maybe desirable in the right circumstances. Let me introduce you to some terminology that you probably have heard. I don't know that everybody has. But have you ever heard the phrase or the term respectable worldliness? You ever heard that phrase used to describe what many people are trying to achieve in this world? Now, the most common idea of worldliness is the idea of overt sin. And so if I were to get up tonight and I were to talk to you about worldliness, well, you'd think, well, he's probably going to talk to us about things like lying and drunkenness and adultery and sodomy and on you could go through all, and that's right, because the Bible explicitly condemns the worldliness that's associated with sin. You adulterers and adulteresses, James 4 and verse 4 asks, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. James chapter 4 and verse 4. We know about that sort of worldliness. But the kind of worldliness that I'm describing to you is not that overt, blatant, obvious to most Christians anyway, that this is just sinful, it's just wrong, it's just something we need to stay away from. I'm talking about a kind of worldliness that's prevalent, not so easily recognized as the enemy of God. A friendship with the world that doesn't look so bad, that doesn't look so horrific. It's the kind of worldliness which is respectable because it is involved with only the good things of this world. It has to do with material things. It has to do with our jobs. It has to do with our families. It has to do with our recreation. It has to do with our education. And yes, all of these material blessings have a place in our lives, but any or all of them can become sinful when we attach more importance to them than to the service of God. Matthew 6:33, Jesus outlines for us a very basic principle when He says, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. So anything that takes me away from putting God first place in my life is really a respectable sort of worldliness. It makes me like nearly everybody else who is around me. There's an increasing number of members of the church who are engaged in respectable worldliness. They're not drunkards. That's not what I mean. When I speak of respectable worldliness, I'm not talking about people that will lie to you. I'm not talking about adulterers. Most of the people I'm talking about wouldn't even want to be found in company with those sorts of overtly worldly people. But if our lives have become so involved with wholesome things to the point that Christ had to be pushed aside in order for me to do that, how often do we hear people saying, I don't have time? And you say, well, why don't you have time? Well, I've got this ball game, or I've got this civic club, or I've got this commitment that I've made. And we get busy earning our wages. We get busy enjoying our ball. We've got to visit our friends. We've got our grandchildren. And consequently, we don't have any time to study the Bible anymore. We don't have time to teach the Bible. We don't have time to attend the services of the church. We don't have time to visit the sick. We don't have time to restore the fallen. We don't mean any harm by all of that. In fact, we say that we love the Lord. But what do our lives demonstrate? They demonstrate misplaced affection. The blessings that this great nation has afforded us have become a curse to the spirituality of the church sometimes. We have all kinds of things to occupy us, all sorts of temptations, I guess you should say, that waste our time rather than use it in good ways. We don't have time for in-depth study of the Bible because really, I don't want the preacher to preach about anything that makes me have to think. I'd really rather have a sermonette during the short time that we set aside for that kind of teaching. I mean, I'll drive all the way across Texas to go to a ball game, but I wouldn't drive 3 miles to a gospel meeting. What does that say? What does it say? I mean, I'll spend hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars on season tickets, and I'll follow that team wherever they may go, but don't ask me to help some widow. Don't ask me to take my money and give that to the Lord so there can be gospel work done some other place. We hardly blink an eye at the debt sometimes that we assume to buy that newest television or to buy that automobile, but we would think a man should be referred to a psychiatrist if he made the same sort of debt in order to preach the gospel someplace. What? He put that on his credit card to do what? Preach the gospel? Oh, but we can buy the accoutrements of life. On and on this analogy could go. Probably wouldn't do much good if I did. But what I'm worried about is that this kind of worldliness has given us a ho-hum attitude toward evil because it seems so respectable. And it doesn't seem to be so overt. And it doesn't seem to be bad. We know the drunkard and the liar and all those people are going to go to hell. And we amen the preacher when he steps on their toes. But can a person be lost because he worked too many hours making an honest living? That's a good question to ask. Could a person be lost because he just attended all the ball games there were to be attended? Or he was always one known to spend time with his friends? And I think the answer to those questions is found in that parable that Jesus taught us in the 14th chapter of Luke and verses 16 through 24 where the certain master gave a feast and he bid people to come to that feast and the people were forbidden to taste of the great supper. And why is it that they were forbidden to taste of that great supper? Was it because they committed some overt act of sin? You know why they didn't received the invitation to come to the supper? Because they were lost over a piece of ground. They were lost over 5 oxen that needed to be proven. They were lost over the fact that I've just married a new wife and therefore I can't come to the supper. Do you see what I'm saying here? Those weren't drunkards. Those weren't liars. Those weren't thieves. But what they were willing to do is to sacrifice what was most important for things that were least important. And the lesson is simple, to put God first. Drew mentioned Matthew 16:26 this morning. For what is a man profited if he should gain the whole world? But in the process of gaining the world, he loses his own soul. I want you to think about that. I think about it. Rather not. I really would. But I think we have to think about those things because we've got to increase our awareness of the ways that evil is slowly seeking to poison us. It's not going to come at us in a bottle with skull and crossbones. It's not going to be given to us in one big dose that we can hardly swallow it before it's killed us. We need to realize that troubles and challenges are a part of our physical existence, and in our awareness of all of the ungodly influences in our lives, we need to build the kind of trust in God that causes us always to turn to Him, never away from Him, and that we be careful to not allow the things of this world to cloud our judgment when it comes to serving God in our daily lives, to put Him first, and not to swallow little by little by little the poison that will rob us of our spirituality. That's the lesson that I've come to share with you tonight. If you're not a Christian, you need to be one. There are two ways to live your life. And we often have spoken of what Jesus has said in Matthew 7 about the broad way and the narrow way. In fact, I talked about that recently, I think last Sunday, in a sermon on how many people are going to be saved. But you have to make the decision about what kind of life you're going to lead. The Lord's not going to make that decision for you. He will decide for you what the best way is, but you have to buy into that and you have to accept that. And you have to decide that I'm going to serve God with all of my heart, with all of my soul, with all of my strength. And I'm going to do everything that I possibly can to refuse the entrance of some poison into my mind or into my spirit that's going to separate me from seeking first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. The only person that can guard you in that way is you. Nobody else can do it for you. They can suggest things. They can warn you. They can even decide we can't have fellowship with you. But in the final analysis, it'll be up to you to make the decision about who you're going to serve and how you're going to serve Him. Think about Daniel and the environment in which he was and all of the onslaughts of evil that were brought against him and how time after time after time, in the big things as well as the small things, he decided that he was going to be true to his God and he was going to be faithful, and it set him apart. And God's still looking for people that will be that sort of person in our generation. Let us know tonight if you need to obey the gospel by repenting of sin, confessing Christ, and being baptized into Him. Or if you're a child of God and you need our prayers and our encouragement, let us know how we can be of help to you. While together we stand and while we sing.